You're listening to the Clear Creek Resources Podcast from Clear Creek Community Church, located in the Bay Area of Houston.
Well, hey, everyone. Welcome to the Clear Creek Resources Podcast. I'm Ryan Leighton.
I'm Rachel Chester.
Thanks for listening today. The hope is that this podcast will help us to better connect with the people of Clear Creek and continue the conversation beyond our weekly worship services. So we've been in a series called Sticky, and as part of that sermon series, we want to continue the conversation after the fact. And so right when we get done hearing that message, or when the preacher gets done preaching that message, we jump into the podcast studio and continue the conversation from there. And so thanks for joining us for this conversation. Rachel, you and I, we got to sit down with Yancey right after his message on marital strife. So maybe you could give those listening a quick preview of what that conversation entailed.
Yeah, I think it was really fun. I think we had a great conversation that was honest, that was helpful. They just talked about sort of the hard things that come whenever you are a follower of Jesus and you're trying to honor God in your marriage, but there's just real personality conflict. There's real things that happen. And what does it look like to love and serve your spouse and follow Jesus and be in community in the middle of these just really hard moments in marriage? I think it was helpful, and I'm thankful for how much our church and our pastors speak into those things.
Yep, me too. All right, let's get to it. All right, Yancey and Rachel, thank you guys for joining me in this conversation.
Yeah.
Thanks for having us. Yeah.
All right, so we're continuing the conversation right after. Yancey, you just got done preaching. Just got done preaching. You got your bottle of water. You've gotten a chance to rest for a second.
Yep.
So obviously, this is during the Sticky series. We're talking about topics that we tend to avoid talking about. And so today, we're discussing marital strife, marital conflict. And so maybe we just begin by talking about, why do you think people tend to hide their struggles, even from people who are close to them? Because I feel like what happens is you have someone who has, you know, they have some sort of struggle. They've maybe gone so far down the road, now they're filing for divorce. And you have people around them that are saying, gosh, they seem so happy, I would have never known.
Yep.
So why do you think people tend to hide those struggles?
Well, and I appreciate the question. I want to answer it and just remind people that, and you know, we also have Rachel and obviously Ryan who's asking the question. Let's just dialogue. Let's this whole thing can be a conversation. So if y'all think of something better than I can, which would probably be really easy to do, let's run with that as well. But initially, what I would say is there's probably a lot of competing factors. One, we live in suburbia. It's hard in suburbia not to fall into the temptation that everything's got to look right. You got to have the right car. Got to live in the right neighborhood. Got to have your kids going to the right school, wearing the right clothes. And that part and parcel means I have to have the right kind of a marriage, which in this illusory world that we live in, it can't have any cracks in it. It can't have any struggles. And I sure can't show that to anybody, because if you look at our social media, and I address this in the message, if you look at our social media, I mean, no one's, I mean, making fun of it, you know, come over here, let's, you know, on the count of three, let's cry and take a picture of our worst battle. I mean, we just don't do that because we're somewhat emotionally intelligent not to post that stuff online. But at the same time, We can almost make it feel like our marriages have to be this way because, one, the temptation to always look right. Two, I think somewhat of the media that we feed ourselves upon or the stories that we read always have to be these kind of fairy tale-esque. You know, if you're addicted to romantic comedies and you think that your marriage needs to be one more romantic than a comedy, then, you know, there's just a bunch of inputs that you can have that can make you feel like you just have a very incorrect silhouette of what a marriage should be. And part of that silhouette for a lot of people is little to no conflict. And if there is that, well, then I sure can't let someone know that my marriage is having stress in it, because it would say there's a problem. And if that says there's a problem, maybe there's something wrong with me. When usually it's kind of like, no, it's definitely something wrong with my husband, but I'm part and parcel with that. So I think there's just a lot of different dynamics. And then what I addressed in the message, if you're a Christian, you might start to really self-doubt, going, gosh, I thought God, you can have all kinds of wacky theology, which says that, you know, God promised me to have a good marriage as long as I included him in it, which there's nowhere in the Bible that says that. Now, should you have a Christ-honoring, God-centered marriage? Absolutely. But that's to help you endure conflict, not to give you the absence of it. But some people, they have that. They got some kind of weird theology that says I'm supposed to be healthy, happy, and wise, and that includes my marriage, and it should always be like that. So if they have problems in their marriage, they may also think, in addition to living in suburbia and addicted and being in addition to an image-driven world and the way social media does, now I got to add this whole idea that as a believer somewhere I have to think, gosh, if my marriage isn't good, it's because I don't have enough faith in God, or he's failing me, or oftentimes my husband or my wife, my spouse, if they were just better Christians. And so now they start to doubt them, even their faith. So I think I've obviously ran off a string of different answers. It's a matrix of things feeding into it. But in the end, it just becomes a sticky subject. So, and then people just want to speak in generalities. Well, you know, we got some struggles. And probably part of that is we don't know how to have deep relationships with anybody. We don't know how to have real friendships. Because if you have real friendships, and I mean real godly friendships, or frankly, even just real friendships, God doesn't even have to be in it. Although I think godly friendships are the best ones. If you really know what friendship is, you have really godly friends, man, those are the people you should be leaning on as well for insight and commiseration and all these other kinds of things. So we don't know how to do that very well either. That's why I think small groups are so important. But with that being said, that's my long-winded answer. I'd be curious to know what you guys think about it. Why it's so sticky.
Well, I think you touched on two things that I think are really important. And one is that talking about your struggles in marriage, or any struggles maybe within your marriage, so talking to your husband or your wife about, this is really what's going on with me, being fully known, takes vulnerability. And that is just hard. That takes courage in your relationships. Yep. It takes trust. It takes time. And then you move that outward to your other friendships and relationships as well. And that just, it just takes courage and trust. And those are things that take time and that we're not really trained to desire in our culture. It's really countercultural, yeah. I think, to be vulnerable, really vulnerable, because you can all be like, oh yeah, my, like you said, like generally, yeah, we're not perfect, but to really say, hey, this is exactly what we're struggling with. Or to tell your spouse, like, hey, this is what I'm struggling with right now, and it's hard. That takes a lot of vulnerability, which we want to protect ourselves from that. And I think the other thing you talked about was really what we think marriage is for in our society. You know, I mean, when we post on social media or we just want to show people, oh yeah, like you talk about theology and our faith, like this, our marriage is supposed to be good because we're Christians. I think we don't really know, like, why did God give us marriage? What's supposed to happen in our marriage? And I think maybe a misunderstanding of that, or maybe just not thinking about that all the time, that feeds into that mentality too. Because we think like God gave us marriages so we're happy and everything looks great. Or maybe it was for something else, you know, and maybe if we all talked about...
Well, if I turn the question to you then, what would you say then as a Christian, what does the Bible say, as best as you can formulate, what is then the purpose of marriage? Because if I came to you, not me, but if someone said, well, Rachel, I thought it was to be happy. I mean, I got married because I thought I would be happy. I mean, what's the purpose then of it? What would you say?
Well, and I would say that's, you know, a complicated question, but I mean, essentially, you know, God said, like in Genesis, let's just go to like Genesis.
Yeah, sure.
You know, it's not good for man to be alone. I'm going to give you someone to help you for all the tasks I've given to you. So to rule the world, to represent me as my image bearer in this world. We need each other, man and woman, for that. And that is most shown in marriage, right? That's where you're going to see that lived out in the most explicit way, like not only in marriage, but the most explicit way. And then, so I think that's one purpose of marriage, yeah, is that it's not good to be alone. And another is that it's one of the primary ways that God will sanctify us in our Christian faith. So, you know, God gave me Aaron not to make me happy in the sense of how our culture talks about that. So I just feel fulfilled and everything's good for me all the time. And he's just telling me that I'm awesome and pretty and this food's good. It's not burnt. Everything's good. But it's really to transform me into the image of Christ, who's my Savior. That is our marriage. And for me, Aaron, it's the primary way that God does that in my life. And so I think to really understand that's really the purpose of marriage, is being conformed to the image of Christ, to show the faithfulness of God to his people, to be missionaries, to show like this is what Christ and the church looks like, all those things, you know, that's a big answer. But that's, I do think that understanding the purpose of marriage is sort of a really essential way to start talking about anything in marriage, whether it's conflict or anything.
Well, and I think that's what's interesting. You think, you know, you talked about how we struggle to really know what the purpose of marriage is. And one of the reasons is because we don't see it modeled for us very well. And so we get discipled or we get tutored about what is marriage by, you know, romantic comedies and things like that. And one of the things, gosh, it's my pet peeve is when you watch some, you know, drama on TV or some romantic comedy or something, and there's like a moment of conflict and the two people are looking at each other and then it just like fades to black and that's it. And like they move on or they do something like that, or they just kind of walk away. And, you know, Lindsay and I will just turn at each other and just, we just get so frustrated because you're like, that's not how it really is.
That's not how the Simpsons should act.
Yeah. Cause that's, you know, that's what we're watching all the time. But it's just, you know, I think about that's how a lot of times people are being discipled on how they're going to learn how to handle conflict and how they're going to be married is this, that never really shows the other side of it. Like the back end of how did this actually get resolved? And so it drives me crazy because people just, we all struggle. I don't want to say it's other people, even myself. We all struggle with handling conflict well, and marriage is a great place to actually learn that. And you learn a lot of times through your parents' marriage and other marriages that are around you. And
well, that's what I was going to say. I mean, you bring up a good point, and I appreciate what Rachel, how she drew a circle around what marriage looks like, especially Christian marriage, how it's supposed to be sanctifying. But I mean, to me, you mentioned really your family of origin. I think some people, it's not that they don't understand that there's conflict in the marriage. They don't know how to do conflict. And what I mean by that is they actually know what to do in conflict. They're just doing all the wrong things in it because of how they grew up. So I'll use my family as an example, and I think I can get away with this responsibly, right? My father grew up in a physically abusive home, right? And so he saw the sinful way you do conflict. Frankly, a horrible way to be exposed to conflict. And so when he came and started his own family, when he married my mom, and then he had us three, you know, his three sons, me being the oldest of three here, he just brought how did my dad and mom do conflict? In his, you know, his dad was the abusive one, his mom was the recipient of that domestic abuse, and they subsequently got divorced. And my dad, you know, this stays with you forever, right? So my dad came into marriage thinking this is just how this works. And a lot of people who experience that kind of trauma will be like, I'll never be that person. But the problem is it's hard to escape from ground zero of your trauma. And so his way to do conflict just bubbled up, not in physical abuse by any stretch, though that's what he experienced in his childhood, but by more emotional, just everything just wasn't normal. And this is before my father became a Christian at the age of 40. And so, 42, I should say. So I think about that with a lot of people. Now, when my father became a Christian, really how he did conflict changed. And he wanted to do the right thing even before he was a believer. Loved his kids, loved his wife. But because he learned certain ways and had patterns provided for him about what marital strife looks like and how you deal with it, there was just a lot of people that were like, oh, this is how you do it. It's like, no, that's not how you do it. There's a godly way to do that. And this is not reconciling anybody or anything. Rachel, do you want to jump in on that?
Well, I think it's so important what you're saying, because you're talking about your family. Yep. And like, this is what happened with him. But I think what is so important for us to realize is that, A, like you talked about in your sermon, it all starts with us. Like, I think the most important thing that to know in your marriage is like, this is really, I'm the most important problem. So how can I be transformed? How can I do things differently? But we all bring these ways of engaging in conflict into our marriage. Yeah. Everybody does. We all have, one of the things that I have learned over the past couple years in school and through some teachers is that most of the time when we're engaged in conflict, it's the same fight over and over and over. So it might be about you're unloading the dishes the wrong way.
Yep.
Which, you know, maybe that's a real thing or something that actually someone has wronged you. But it really doesn't matter. Whatever it is, we're triggered in some way. And then our brains actually automatically go into some response because it's a learned behavior. And that's just how we respond. And so it takes recognizing that, which is really what you're talking about, is saying, okay, this is a learned behavior. Something happens and this is how I deal with it every time. And it's always in the flesh. This is always how, you know, I've been wronged, and so this is how I'm dealing with it. And so the first step in any conflict with anyone, but really in your marriage, is what are those things that I do?
Yeah.
You know, what have I learned from my family? What did I do whenever I was younger that I've brought into my marriage that's really going on whenever we move into these conflicts? Because it's always destructive, because it's always about, you know, it's really identity issues.
Yeah, and one of the reasons I wanted us as a people to look at the 2 Corinthians 5 passage, which I said really is ultimately about salvation, that in Christ we have been reconciled to the Father, now not sinners, but sons and daughters, and the reason I like that, not only because it highlights the value in the kingdom ethic of reconciliation, but it also reminds us that we do have a new identity. We do have a new, I mean, back to my family story, when my dad became a Christian, he wasn't perfect by any stretch. But the way we did conflict completely changed, or at least changed. It's complete. Yeah, it was really drastic. For the same reasons I hope that we believe when we looked at the 2 Corinthians text where I talked about that we have a new power source, the Holy Spirit. We have a new identity. Jesus has placed us by his work through the gospel into a new sphere. So I think we have to do very well to recognize what's the stuff that I'm bringing into this marriage. What are the patterns that I've learned? They're not always good ones. There's bad ones as well. And then, but I'm not stuck in that because of the work of Jesus and hopefully an applied discipleship in my life. And I think that means like getting around mentors, getting into disciple, you know, getting some people can help you, getting resources. So, you know, now when it got into my family, talking about Yancey and Jennifer, it was a clash of civilizations when we got married. So to use Ken Sandy's line, so Ken Sandy wrote the book Peacemaker, so we'll put this in the liner notes, if you will, we'll give you a link to this book. It's a book that we so liked at Clear Creek, we did a series off of it, where Ken Sandy talks about what does biblical conflict resolution look like. And one of the things I liked about the book, what he said is, you know, the goal is to be a peacemaker, reconciling. It's what the text we looked at today, or in my sermon. But he talks about, like, if you don't do that, you can either be a peace faker or a peace breaker. And so in my family growing up, although my father was a Christian, we still it's my dad. There's three of us boys. We're all athletes. My mom's an athlete. We're all kind of type A aggressive. So when we go eat, it's like, you know, it's eat as much food as you can. Or if you don't, someone else is going to eat it. And when we had a problem with anyone in our family, we'd get it out right then and there and deal with it. But sometimes the way we dealt with it emotionally probably wasn't the best way. It's over the top. You know, we could scream and shout, yell, whatever. Still loved each other. But I think for people looking outside in, they're like, yo, that's not how you do that. And so we were probably more peace breakers just by the way we did things. My wife, and I know I'm free to share this because I've shared this publicly before. My wife is one of four girls, grew up in a home where everyone's quiet about things. They don't share anything. They're the retreaters. They're the barriers. Let's keep relational distance if we have a problem. And so they would be what Sandy would call peace fakers. It's not really the absence of conflict's not peace. And so when she and I got married, it's just we're doing the exact opposite things on how to fix stuff. And so I don't know how many times she cried our first year of marriage. You know, I'm like, I thought this was, when did the honeymoon, when does it begin? Because we had to learn, like, what is the way of Jesus in our marriage for this? What is the way for, because we don't want to live like this. And you know, it's not that it was all horrible.
So what was it?
What was the way of Jesus?
Yeah.
Well, I think it's several different things. I think just the ones that come to mind was learning how she's wired and how I'm wired would be one. And this is not like every personality test we could ever take. They weren't even popular back then. So there's no Enneagram, Rachel. I'm sorry that they didn't back in the day.
You would have been there a lot sooner.
I would have been there a lot sooner. Oh, I wish. So Just the fact that, so Jennifer and I, so here's what we did. We talked about what are going to be our rules of engagement. Like any battle that you ever got into, militaries call an ROE, a rule of engagement. And so we just said, how are we going to fight?
So this is such an 8-1 marriage.
Oh my gosh. Well, I don't want to Enneagram this out. Cause I don't know half of what this stuff means, but we would just talk about how we wanted to structure this. And we talked about, you know, it's not healthy when we get historical. Like when you did this, that, and the other, and we go through this litany of things, like, you know, I'm calling her before the court of all the transgressions she's done or I've done. We talked about we're not going to speak in absolutes. You always do that. You never do this. That's just not true. But because we're angry, we speak in absolutes. So we said, we're not going to do absolutes. We're trying to, you know, the scripture says, don't let the sun go down on your anger. I don't want to take that so legalistically that if something was so bad, I may need more time to work it out. But generally speaking, when we have problems, we deal with those problems and we don't let things fester. And it's on the person who's offended to initiate it. So I think
that's a really big thing.
Okay.
Because I think that people, like, we'll take a verse out of the Bible and be like, well, this is so, like, you're not going to sleep until we, like, resolve this whole issue. And so
instead of understanding the heart of why Jesus.
Yeah, instead of understanding.
Same
like,
thing, like, you don't pray in your closet all the time, do you? No, what Jesus is really trying to, we see. Yeah.
I really do, because I think people are like, no, we have to, whenever sometimes space and, you know, being able to think through it and taking a break is a good thing.
Yeah, people process it differently. I mean, even just like, you know, the answer you talked about in your message that you and Jennifer, there's other people who have probably similar experiences where one person thinks, you know, clearer and, you know, whenever they're getting going, the other person needs time to process. So some person's like, no, we got to finish this right now. And the other person, they need some space.
What are you?
They actually need it.
What are you and Lindsay? Because I agree with that. So one of the reasons we didn't make a we try to finish and get our fights done so we don't go to bed angry, but we try not to go to bed angry anyhow. Sometimes I just need to recognize Jennifer needs more time to process. And so we're going to continue this conversation, but her processing is, I process in milliseconds. She doesn't. So it's not fair. So you guys, when you and Lindsay go after it, how does that work for y'all?
I mean, I would say I would have a hard time nailing down exactly how I am. Because in one way, I would say I probably process quickly and...
what kind of information do you process quickly?
That's probably that too. I don't know.
Like, do you process emotional stuff quickly?
I'm just going to sit back and watch
all
this.
All I know is, if you want to get into the Enneagram stuff, so I'm a three. So when a three gets stressful or whenever there's like a conflict, tends to go into like the nine and starts to retreat a little bit. So there's like the part of me that would retreat, but that's the unhealthy part of me. And then there's the part of me that also can get more, you know,
like logical,
fired up and logical. So I don't know. I mean, you're an Enneagram expert. Like, what's wrong with me?
I have no clue what anyone's talking about. No. Just so y'all know out there.
No, I think that, like, we're joking about the Enneagram, but it's just a way to understand your spouse and yourself, which I think is a huge part of engaging in conflict in a way that's, where you can confess, this is really the sinful patterns I have, like you're saying, and understanding your spouse, really taking the time to understand this is how, I mean, because Aaron and I have... I think, you know, you talked earlier in the political sermon, there's some things that have like moral connotations and some don't. Same thing in our marriage, right? Sometimes we're just different, and just recognizing that's really important. So like when we're in a conflict, Aaron is a physical touch guy. And if you're at our campus, everyone is laughing because you can't walk in the door and he is like hugging you or shaking your hand or jumping on you. That's just how he is. And I'm not. And so especially if I'm in stress, like I need space, like don't touch me if I'm in stress. Aaron's the opposite. If he's stressed out or upset, whether it's like between us or something else going on in his life, like just to put your hand on his shoulder will bring him peace and comfort.
So how does that work when you guys are oil and water?
Yeah, exactly. And so we've had to, first of all, recognize that that's okay, that there's not a right way to be.
Yeah.
You know, that it's okay that I'm like that and that he's like that. But then also, like, I have to move towards Aaron and he has to sometimes let me have space. And so I think part of it is just recognizing there's differences that are okay, but you still have to always be thinking about the other person, right? Be other-centered in your marriage, which is part of what we're called to in marriage.
So basically you're saying you have to be unselfish? That's the root of it all, frankly. It's like, I shared in the message the target, I'd like to think I aim for reconciliation, but often I'm really trying to be, I'm aiming for right. Because you can almost justify it. Right's a good thing. We want to be right. We should do the just thing. And if I feel like I'm in an argument and I'm right, that's such a dangerous place for me to be relationally with my wife, because usually it's never about something cataclysmic. I mean, we're almost always copacetic on major issues. But if I feel like I'm right, that, you know, she left the light on. I'm going to do something this pedantic that means nothing. She left the light on. I've told her 1,000 times not to leave the light on. She agrees that she shouldn't leave the light on, but she still did. And I'm mad that she did that. I know that's a dumb illustration. I'm just trying to get something like, you know, something we've agreed to in the past, and she still somehow did something. And I will try to just root myself in and position myself like, listen, I know I'm not leaving this chair because I'm right. So however this ends, I'm going to be on top. You're not going to be victorious, Jennifer. And that alone has ruined so many. I mean, I've taken like level three fights and made them level 23 level fights over the dumbest things because I want to win. And that's where I use the, you know, I said it in my message, you know, I'm winning arguments, but I'm losing my relationship with my wife. And,
and Aaron has told me just because you won the argument doesn't mean you're right. Because he's similar to where, like, conflict is hard for him. Mm. He will sort of shut down in a conflict. And so he's like, that doesn't mean you're right. And 15 years ago, I was like, pretty sure it does.
In a court of law, it would.
Like, I think actually. And he's like, no. And I finally realized that's true, too. Yeah. Like, I'm not even right just because I engage that way in a fight.
Well, and for me, I think that's very helpful. What's been helpful for me is my goal is to love, not to win. My goal is to love. I have to tell myself that, Yancey, your goal is to love, not to win. But there's a justice streak in me where I'm like, but sometimes you ought to win this thing. I'm like, not really. Because in the end, we're on the same team. I mean, let's fight things together, not between each other. And that doesn't mean that I'm not one averse to conflict, and my wife really isn't either. But what we've had to do over time is almost say to each other, like, here's what we need to talk about with this issue. Here's how, yeah, there's times where my wife's like, Yancey, I'm just not in a good mood. I think this is what's going on. I can't tell you how helpful that is in our marriage, which is like to kind of have enough self-awareness. And I'm praising her. And I've tried to find out, like, how can I be more self-aware about my own patterns? And there's just been times where I've been like, Jennifer, I think I don't know why I'm so irked about this. It's probably something else going on. I can't put a finger on it. So let's just know that going in. And that really has helped temper some of the catalytic emotion that can sometimes pop up in that, just by acknowledging, like, listen, man, I don't know what's going on in my head or heart, but it's affecting us enough to where I'm probably not going to fight fairly right now. And I just need to, you know, I don't know. Y'all ever talk about that kind of stuff, Ryan?
Well, I would say that's really huge. I mean, that was the whole point of your message, talking about how, like, when we're aiming for reconciliation, gospel reconciliation, and that reconciliation is founded on love, it then changes how we engage in some kind of conflict. And so I was thinking about, you know, your example of, you know, you and Jennifer, which I think applies to many people, where you have one person that may get more clear, fired up, you know, they're going to be a good fighter versus the other person who maybe retreats a little bit more. But that changes whenever reconciliation is the goal, all of a sudden it changes how you engage in that
conflict.
No, you're
right. It changes the how.
Yeah. So that person now, all of a sudden, who's maybe a little bit more forceful, or maybe they're a better arguer, instead of trying to win that argument, they're gonna now think, all right, how can I set up my spouse for the win here? So how can I engage in a way that helps he or she speak their mind in the way they really need to? And if that means give them space, or if that means I need to, you know, bring my tone down lower, or, you know, I want to level the playing field. But, you know, not that it is a fight, but more just being able to, I want to love that person well, so they can express how they've been hurt, and I want to be able to hear that well. And, you know, it just changes everything whenever reconciliation is the goal and not winning. Or,
and I think that's true for no matter which pathway you take, you know, when you're talking about your sermon, even if you're someone who withdraws, you're still trying to win.
Yeah.
You know, you're just trying to win in a different way.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're not necessarily aggressive. And so I think what you guys are both saying is like, when you're thinking about your spouse, when you're thinking about their good and their emotions, then no matter which path you're taking, it's still about them instead of you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I just want to reaffirm what you said. And I almost wish I had more time in my sermon to say it, because
why we're here.
Yeah, I get you. We're continuing the conversation. When love is your aim, I mean, and by that you're trying to reconcile. Like, I really want us to end. Like, we're in the room called conflict. I want us to walk out that exit door together, right? Copacetic, stacked hands, all on the same team. If that really is your aim, it really does impact. You just start thinking about the how. You're not even thinking about the what. When I'm angry, I tend to think about the what. What do I? You know, this is what's wrong. Here's what's right. And I don't care much about my delivery, because I'm angry. I'm letting it fly. I'm thinking faster. It's almost like I feel good about my position, but it's almost backwards when it's like, all right, I'm gonna talk with Jen, or she may be saying the same thing to me, and I've got to think, how do I do this in a way she can best hear this? How can I do this in a way? And I think, as easy as that is to say, that is one of the hardest things to do, especially for those of us that are more emotionally wired. We, you know, the trigger just got switched and bam, I'm angry. Now let's talk about this now. Sometimes I almost have to have a conversation with myself before I have a conversation with my wife. It's like, Yancey, what does the gospel say about how we're going to do this, buddy? Well, dang it, I probably need to say it this way. And those fights have been actually good fights. I mean, I don't think we run to conflict, but you can have really good fights. Like, we needed to have that. And we came out of that stronger because of how we loved each other well. And then there's those fights where it's like, I mean, I've had fights where they were bad fights, and I had to come back and just say, babe, I blew that as the, you know, and as the husband, I feel like I'm responsible for, as the leader. I feel like I'm the leader in that. I'm like, I blew it. And she's done that same thing. She's like, I didn't handle that well. And I think you can actually have a good result after a bad fight if you both repent well of it. But you really want to have, like, you shouldn't fear fighting. You should fear fighting in a way that's not helpful. But man, if you can fight well, dang, you can grow. I mean, I feel like my wife, we're not experts in it, but we are, I think, 24 years of marriage. My wife, I would consider my best friend. She is my best friend. I really do. I mean, God's grace. But I really probably enjoy my marriage more now than I've ever enjoyed it. And I think she would say the same, because I feel like, not that we have unlocked the combination perfectly, but we really do try to love each other well in that, because we've seen what it's like when we don't. It's not fun. I mean, when you have a fight that's over, but it's really not over emotionally because someone's retreating and we're not intimate like we should be emotionally, all these other things. It's just, I have words I want to say. I can't put them on this podcast. It's just not good.
Yeah.
So it's all important to try to figure out the how is critical.
All right, so that all sounds really great, right? In an ideal world, you know, everyone has got the gospel at the center of what they're, how they're thinking and how they're behaving when it comes to that. You talked about the four horsemen of the apocalypse.
Yeah.
And, you know, the criticism, which sort of builds into this contempt, which then moves into this defensiveness, which then moves into stonewalling. And it's almost like I get this picture of a train that starts out slow and it's just picking up baggage as it's going.
That's the Gottman study, right? Is that Dr. Gottman? Yeah.
So it's just building momentum to the point where it's like, how do you actually reverse that? And I see it time and time again where somebody will call up to the office, or they want to see a counselor, or if it's just a friend and they say, here's the situation. And it feels like, man, that train is already going and you can't reverse it. Like, I've already done too much damage now to actually reverse what I've done, because my wife or my husband or whoever, they've just gone cold. I mean, they're stonewalling and I can't do anything to get them back.
Yeah.
So what would you say to someone who is trying to reverse some damage or a lot of the damage that they have already done?
Man, it's a great question. I think it just depends. It depends on how long they've been in it. It depends upon how deeply embedded those patterns are. It depends upon how long they let this go. Because I do think there's times it's like, well, listen, you guys need professional help. You need some, and by that I mean you need some real Christian, Christ-centered counseling, because you're going to have to, you really need a third party to step in and say, they need to hear your stories, they need to see your patterns, they need to, because you may need to have someone outside of that. And, you know, I think it just depends. Sometimes that can be your small group, but sometimes I think it's okay to say, listen, you need to call up someone at Clear Creek Community Church. We have a counseling team, a pastoral care team, that they need to help you work through these things where you can calmly, in an emotionally stable environment, share your stuff. And this individual who's been trained is going to help you work through some of this stuff. So maybe it's going to help you identify, and Rachel, I'm going to be coming to you here in a second, that it's going to help you identify some of those patterns, may give you some practices you need to do to get you back on a positive progressive path. But I mean, I think you can burn your house down so many times that it's just, you got to have someone come in and help you out. And I don't want to make that taboo either. I think there are a lot of Christians that are like, I can't do counseling, which, if you look through the scriptures, especially like Proverbs, like godly counsel is a great thing. This is a counselor, is just someone who's been trained specifically in certain areas to help you work through that. So again, good Christian counseling is just like, you know, I've got pastor friends of mine. Nothing's really wrong at all. They go to counseling just because it's a good practice, right? We try to use our small groups in a sense to help people walk through, because I just think it's an extension of discipleship. But all that being said, there are times where if it's in the way that you described it, you've gone through the four horsemen, you're on that last horseman of stonewalling,
yep,
and now hearts are getting bitter and it's just spiraling. I think it's, you know, there's no shame in seeking real healthy counsel. But I mean, Rachel, I know that you've studied counseling. It's, you know, part of your educational stuff. So just tell me what you think about that.
I think that something both of y'all are talking about and that we've touched on that's really important is that, you know, understanding the gospel and that being central to your identity and your life and your marriage doesn't mean these things don't take effort and time and work and relationship. You know, we don't want those things to be opposed to each other. Mm-hmm. So the gospel is the center of everything. It's the why, it's the how, it's the what, it's the end game. But we need relationship and we need discipline and we need help. And that's okay. So when we say remind yourselves of the gospel, we don't mean you can't learn new behaviors and ask experts what it looks like to engage in new ways. Mm-hmm. Because I think people get confused about that. And then the other thing that that makes me think about is just, you know, I think that sometimes when we're talking about relationships in church, and we talk about disciplines like being in the Word and prayer, and we know we do that in small group, but sometimes we don't pull that into our marriage, which is the most important relationship we have and the primary way that God changes us too. And so I think, like, just to remember that God isn't distant. He's not handing down commandments about our marriage. He's invested. He's personal. He's part of the covenant that we have with our spouse. So to invite him into our marriage and to, I mean, like, I would just challenge you, if you've never set aside a time to pray with your spouse out loud. I mean, that's so simple, but it can really be transformative to have your spouse touch you and pray out loud for you. It's vulnerable, but it really can be transformative. And so I think inviting God into your marriage and having the humility to be in community about your marriage, those are the most important things you can do whenever you're really just stuck and don't know what to do next. I would also say that almost all marriages who have gone through really, really hard times see the other side. So if you feel that way and you're listening, almost all marriages who feel that desperate, they see the other side of that and they're happy years later. And the flip side of that is that people who are divorced end up unhappy as well. It doesn't actually change anything.
Yeah, you know, the only reason I even respond is because it grieves me a little bit. I can't remember exactly. Well, I don't know why I would remember exactly the reference, but I remember a study was done on divorce and unhappy marriages, and you know, it's kind of everywhere in the process. And they, the result was something to this effect. I won't get this probably exactly right, but it'll be close enough. It was like 97%, or maybe it was 99%. I think it was like 97%, somewhere around there, a high percentage of all conflicts in marriage can be worked out in a way that the marriage is stronger as a result. Like if 97% of all marriages, if they'll just stick through the conflict, will result in better marriages instead of just automatically saying, well, we're just not good for each other. We just don't have that kind of stick-to-itiveness, generally speaking, right? With that said, though, and I appreciate, I mean, I totally agree with what you said. I see it all as discipleship. I just don't want people to think counseling is something outside of that. But I'd be curious, Ryan. I mean, you're, of the three of us here, you're a campus pastor. You're the campus pastor of our largest congregation. When you see people in our congregation that you know and love that are having hard times in, or having a hard time in their marriage because of conflict or strife, or if they've come up to you and said, what do we do? What are the things that, that you tell them? I mean, maybe the same things that we've said, but what do you recommend for people as their, as a pastor?
Yeah. I mean, I think, one thing, it is challenging to the point when someone comes and they contact campus pastor or something like that, they're usually the stonewalling has already,
they're going way down the road by the time they get to you.
They've already gone down the road. And oftentimes, one person wants to reconcile and the other person's so much stonewalled that, you know, they're not really interested. They may not even show up to even, you know, meet with someone like me. And so that's really hard, because to reconcile two parties have to be willing to be reconciled.
Sure.
Some of it is just really trying to assess where people are spiritually in their own relationship with God and their understanding of the gospel. Because if you want to appeal to real gospel reconciliation, I mean, they have to have a full understanding of being reconciled to God. They have to be someone who is transformed by the gospel and is being transformed by the renewing of their mind. And so, you know, it's really trying to talk about how the gospel shapes their own hearts. And and what we've talked about, like, you got to begin with your own sin. And then from there, I mean, a lot of it is just, if they may need, you know, a professional counselor to help them work through some things. Many times people, I mean, even just having a small group, a community of people that they can then start to open up to, that maybe they haven't really even had that before. They don't have relationships where they can talk about that with, you know, talk about what's going on in their marriage in a really godly way, as you talked about in your message. You know, oftentimes it feels like some relationships that we might have where we do talk about our marriage just ends up just being spouse bashing, you know, or gossip, where they're just, you know, it's kind of just, it's venting, it's complaining about, like,
it's actually,
you know,
one way to attack your spouse that you think you get permission to under the guise of discipleship, when it's really slander or gossip or, all those other things you mentioned.
So to really find relationships that are not going to do that might even call you out when you do that. They'll say, hey, you know, this happened, and you're kind of going, you're sort of crossing some lines, and you got someone who says, hey, it's probably not helpful to talk about your spouse in that way, but let's talk about this other thing, and might even challenge you in that. I mean, those would be the biggest things, is how does the gospel apply to yourself? What does it look like to walk in community and try to encourage people to get connected to a small group?
Can I ask you something?
Sure.
So what do you say, or what would you guys say to someone who is in the position where their spouse is done? So their spouse doesn't really want to come to counseling. They themselves recognize that there's issues in their marriage and they want to be better, but their spouse doesn't care. You know, how can they love their spouse and stay committed to their marriage and, you know, committed to God's vision of marriage in that situation?
Yeah, I mean, I guess the advice I've given to people, and I don't know if it's, you know, how it's worked out, but I would say first off is prayer. I mean, sometimes there's only so much you can do and only so much you can say. And sometimes it's just like all you can do is ask that God would work in somebody's heart to repair the damage that you have done. So, I mean, it's maybe even just, you know, talking about what Yancey said at the very end with just the application, just confessing to God. I mean, and really just leaning on Him to change someone else's heart because of the damage that you've done. Then I would say as part of that also is to try to communicate both in your words and your actions, and probably the actions are the most important. What has changed in you, and to confess those things to your spouse. Again, that was Yancey's second point of application there. But then also recognizing that talk is cheap in that situation. Mm-hmm. Whenever you've got years and years of patterns that have been of damage that have been done because of your actions, you saying some words of how you're sorry may not really change. It probably is not going to change anything in them right away, because it's like, all right, let me see how you really live. And so I think that's the next thing is gearing up for time to really love someone in with their actions, and for them to see that, man, the gospel really is changing this person, and allowing God to work in their heart to say, wow, there is a change. And the stories that have come out of a really just hard situation, that seems to be what has happened the most, is the gospel has so transformed the person who let's call is the one who seemed to be the most the offender, I guess, the offending spouse, so transformed that person that it changes how they live and how they act, and all of a sudden they start serving their spouse in ways that they haven't done before. And that kind of repentance that they are seeing in their spouse, God starts to change them and starts to heal a lot of what has been broken. And when they get to the other side, then it's like, wow, yeah, this is the power of the gospel. You know, it changes our hearts and then changes our relationships. So that, I guess that's the advice I give.
That Eugene Peterson quote about the long obedience?
A long obedience in the same direction.
Yeah. I mean, I think that is so apt for marriage too.
Yeah.
You know, it's not usually going to be, you're going to go to counseling one time, you're going to be perfect, or you're going to make a decision today and you're never going to go through these same sinful patterns again. But it's obedience in the same direction for a long time.
Yeah. Well,
and that's what marriage looks like.
You're right. And I think the culture we live in makes that even harder, because we want everything instantly with everything. And so, as I think about through what Ryan has said, I really appreciate that. What I would tell someone, listen, if you've had bad patterns for 5 years, you can't fix that in 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. You can't walk into a pastor's office and expect him to fix that in 5 minutes, because there's some things that you just don't fix that quickly. That's naive. That's not even, you spend all this time tearing a house down, and we're not going to build it back up in 5 minutes, and we may not be able to build it back up at all. In fact, I'm not expecting that of me at all. I need the Lord to do something in you that I can't make you do. So, and another thing you should probably consider for that spouse is, listen, God called you to be a spouse, not a savior. So what I mean by that is, you can't save your spouse. You can't save him or her from all the junk that y'all have gone through. Jesus can. But you just need to be a spouse, and you need to have a savior, and you need to depend upon your savior to make you a better spouse. I mean, everything that Ryan said, I completely concur. It's like, we see this in the New Testament when you saw Corinthian women who were coming to Jesus, who had been married to, who were pagans, obviously, before their husbands remained pagans. And they're like, what do we do, man? Because we might even suffer some domestic violence here if we're not careful. And Paul's like, well, okay, we got some things we got to talk about. But one of the things he did say, though, is, well, one strategy you should have is to win them by the winsomeness of your life that has been changed by the gospel. And that they might be won, right, without the even uttering of a word, because they, you know, as Ryan said, talk is cheap. So if you're the spouse that's kind of blown it up because of your neglect or your whatever it is, husband or wife, listen, this is why you focus on yourself and go, all right, Jesus, I need you to work in me. And I don't make any demands of my spouse. I just want to show them what it looks like now that I've changed and I'm following Jesus. Because think of it this way. I mean, it's a cocoon that my spouse has been wrapped in with my bad behavior or bad behavior over time. I can't just open him up or her up in 2 seconds. I'm hoping by my fidelity to Jesus and my serving Christ and my spouse in a way that the gospel calls me to, that hopefully by the grace of God, layer by layer, that cocoon gets unwound and unwrapped to where my spouse sees that I really do love him or her. I really do want to follow Jesus. And this isn't just a show. And that's got to last longer than 5 minutes and longer than 5 months. So But we've seen that at Clear Creek. I mean, we have people that we've filmed their stories about how they were in marriages that none of us would want to have because they were so full of strife. And Jesus got a hold of somebody. And it wasn't just show. It wasn't just talk. And there was no immediate, everything's fine. But they lived for Jesus in such a way, it wasn't perfect, but the spouse saw there was a real change. And if they can see there's a real change, they can see there's a real hope. And then you never know. Maybe the spouse comes to follow Jesus because of that. And that was what Paul's hope was in Corinthians. And so I want to help people understand that sometimes you got to play the long game, but you got to be willing to follow Jesus in it. Because ultimately, even as you said, Rachel, marriage, of the things that it is for our discipleship. If we're followers of Jesus, it is our sanctifying. It's a sanctifying tool. And we have to be willing to want to grow in Jesus because of it. I'm a better follower of Jesus by far today because I've been married to Jennifer Shannon Arrington than I ever would have been on my own. Now, if you're called to be single, God bless you, right? That just wasn't the path I had. And I'm grateful for that because there's a lot of things I probably still would be today that just aren't like Jesus, that I don't have as much struggles with because I have a wife that called me on the carpet and said, we're not going to put up with that. And so I thought, man, I better listen to her. She's listening to Jesus too. So we've done that for each other, but that's actually been the blessing of marriage. So I think that hope is there for anybody. And I'll just end my part this way. If Jesus is real and the Spirit is real, then there's always hope. There's always hope because God does really change people. We just got to stop looking at our spouse as the one to being changed and look first to us. And then when that happens, we're not looking for our husband or wife to complete us because we realize that we're already complete in Jesus. Now we can actually treat our spouses as spouses, not as saviors or as their own God. So that's what I would say.
All right, so I want to finish our conversation just by talking about living in community, being part of a small group. That was like, your last point for your application is be a part of a small group, confess to that small group. So how do you balance confidentiality and honoring your spouse and what you share in that group, but at the same time, still talk about honest struggles?
Ah, that's a good question because I think that's more of an art than a science. Because you want to be forthright, but appropriately forthright. There's always that person that's saying stuff and everyone's like, they're listening and nodding their heads, but their eyes just got a little wider because they're like, gosh, I can't believe he or her just said that in front of everybody because that almost feels like they're emotionally naive because they might need to tell that to one or two people of the same gender that are very close friends privately, but not to everyone here because we're not all really emotionally mature enough to handle it. Or maybe that's just not something you should say anyhow. I think there is a way to be discerning about that. But I actually would be curious, Rachel, how you think about what would be the most appropriate way or what are appropriate ways to do that. So how are you going to share your stuff with your small group that you and Aaron are struggling with without doing that in a way like what would you consider inappropriate and what would be the appropriate way to do that?
Well, I think the most important thing I think to think about in this, which is really what we keep going back to, is are you talking for yourself or are you talking because you love your spouse and you're trying to grow your marriage? Yep. I mean, I think that it really is a hard issue. And I think that if you really are concerned about your spouse, like I want to serve Aaron. I want our marriage to glorify God. I want people, the purpose behind our marriage is ultimately so people look at us and see, oh, this is how Christ loved the church, and this is how the church submitted and loved Christ. So if that's my goal when I'm talking, and I know that's hard. Like, I understand I'm saying that, and that's hard in those moments. But if that's ultimately what I know is the goal in that moment, then I think I can trust what I say.
Yeah.
So I think it's more about what's the purpose of talking, And you can have hurts, and you can have pain, and that's all real. But if your goal is the same and it's about the other person in the room and it's about glorifying God, then you're probably in a safe place. Because I think there's not like a ton of really specific rules we could hand out, like say this, but don't say this. But what's your motivation?
Yeah, I think that's right. I will say this, what we've done, I'm not saying this is, I think this is wisdom. I think this is a wise thing to do. I wouldn't say it's, I wouldn't laud over anybody, but if I'm going to share something about my marriage with our small group, I talk to my wife before I say that. I said, this is something, do you think, would you be comfortable if we shared this? Because I'm sharing it and she's right there next to me. So I ask for her approval of that. Now, if it's something I want to share about me being a husband, good or bad, I actually, we would break our small group up into where I'm just with the men, mm-hmm. she's just with the women, because I would feel that's appropriate. Hey guys, here's where I'm blowing it in my marriage as a husband, as a father, as a leader, and I confess that to those guys. So to me, it depends on who am I talking about. Am I talking about my whole, yeah, am I talking about really both good. Of us? I'm going to talk with my wife about, can we share that with everybody? And if it's just about me, I might even tell my wife, listen, I'm going to tell the guys that I'm screwing this up, all right? But I'm going to talk to the men about that. So that's how I've done it. Ryan, I'd be curious to know how what you think are kind of, I appreciate what Rachel says about it's hard to, you know, make hard and fast rules about everything, because I think it's more art than science. But what would you say about, like, how do we do that appropriately in small group? Because that is a place we should confess, but how do we do that in a way that's not, it's not inappropriate?
Yeah. For a number of years, I've led a men's group. Lindsay's led a women's group. And even when we did a couples group long ago, we would break up for a prayer request for between men and women. And so I'd say that's where probably most of those conversations would happen, is, you know, with same gender people who are close to you. And I would say, yeah, that tends to be when you're sharing things like that, you're talking about your own sin, your own brokenness, how people can be praying for you in that, and just trying to be careful that what you're sharing isn't somehow like trying to include them still, you know, all right, I've done this, but you know, you could also be praying for, you know, her response.
It's actually
that.
So contempt.
Like, yeah. Yes. So, I mean, that's you're just right. kind of a way of sliding in there, like their issue also, even though you're under the guise that it's all you that you're asking for prayer requests for. So, that's how I handle it. It's just, you know, it's the same thing what we've talked about is dealing with your own sin first and really trying to get the gospel to be applied to all aspects of your life.
Man, I can't stress this enough for everyone who's listening to this. Have deep, godly friendships. The deeper the friendship, the more you can share. That's just how it is. The greater intimacy you have with a friend, you know, and I really want to tell men, you ought to have some really... Men don't use the word intimate, right? Because it's not like something we like in our vocabulary. The stronger relationships you have with other guys will do you well, even when you struggle. Because now you have someone who can talk to that you don't feel weird about. Women who generally can develop relationships, I'm speaking generally, they do that an easier job of that. I mean, ladies ought to have, and Rachel, you can jump in on this, they ought to have really godly friendships of friends that they just know and love, that they can responsibly, not gossip, but responsibly share their stuff with. Because now you, not only do you have a friend in arms who you're going to share stuff with anyhow, now you have a sister. Now I've got brothers who are telling me some stuff that maybe I don't want to hear. And I've got those relationships, and they're as precious as gold, because I know, even if it's not just my small group, it's in addition to that. Like, maybe it was a former small group member and y'all clicked, but I've got friends, I can still pick up the phone and be like, here's where my marriage is going south, y'all. I need y'all to pray, and here's where I'm blowing it. And I've had guys love me well. Sometimes that love is confrontation. Sometimes that love is exhortation. Sometimes that love is encouragement. Sometimes it's all of it. So it's part of that is the oil that can grease the wheels of your marriage, just to have places where you can, because your spouse can't bear everything, and they're not supposed to, but that's why God gives us other people as well.
So. Yeah. Amen. All right. Let's wrap it up there. Thank you guys for continuing this conversation together about marital strife.
Thanks, Ryan.
Yeah, it's good. All right, for those of you who are listening, thank you for joining this on this episode of Clear Creek Resources. I hope our conversation just gave you really a hope for marriages and what that might look like. And for those of you who are struggling, I want you to know that as a church family, we are there to walk with one another. So if you're not in a small group, make sure that you get connected to a small group. We want to help you do that. If you need counseling, well, we want to help connect you with a counselor. Or if you just need to talk to your campus pastor, make sure that you reach out to do that. We want to love you well in this season. If you haven't yet subscribed to the Clear Creek Resources podcast, make sure that you do that wherever you listen. Also, we're going to put some resources in the description of this episode at clearcreekresources.com. org, some books, articles, things that might be helpful for you. And while you're there, you can check out some of the other content that we have on the site. All right, that's it. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.